Welcome to Professor Todd Landman's podcast series. In today's podcast, Todd talks about his new, freely available book, Human Rights and Democracy, The Precarious Triumph of Ideals.
Well, I'd been at the University of Essex for close to 20 years when I thought about the book, and the 20 years had been working in the Human Rights Center here, the Department of Government, but also further afield. So I'd spent time in over 35 countries working on questions of governance, either with academic practitioners, communities, non-governmental organizations, etc. And I wanted to write a book that summarized sort of my thinking after 20 years on big questions of, around human rights and democracy. The idea was to provide a fairly accessible discussion of the key themes that dominate a lot of debate today around democracy and human rights.
So what would you say the book is about?
The book is about transformation and change and where that comes from. And it has an individual sort of human struggle and desire for change behind a lot of what it has to say, that there are inherent appeals of the concepts of human rights and democracy within people. They take up struggle, hopefully peacefully, but in some instances not necessarily so, depending on how the state they're operating in might react. But there is this sort of constant desire for these ideals. I call them precarious ideals, because once you win them, they can be taken away, etc. But the struggle for human rights and democracy is one that is really made up of agency, that people are trying to change the world, and sometimes they succeed. And when they succeed, they see the value of those ideals. And when they don't succeed, they still see the value, but they continue to struggle for them. So it's a real story about that precariousness, the constrained agency of people trying to change the world.
Now, you stress that you're not trying to bash those newer democracies that might be criticised for failing to do as much as some think they should when it comes to human rights, but rather you describe it as a cautiously optimistic book about that triumph of ideals. What do you mean by that?
It's very cautiously optimistic because it suggests that people can change the world, they can achieve these things. And the end of the book, actually, I have a passage I call A Tale of Three Women. And it asks the reader to think of the three women I actually talk about. One is Aung San Suu Kyi from Burma, Myanmar. The other is Dilma Rousseff from Brazil. And the third is Michelle Bachelet from Chile. And the reason I highlight these three women is that if you go back to the 1970s, two of them were enemies of the state and had been imprisoned and then exiled. One had been under house arrest a bit later than the 70s, obviously, in Burma. And yet, if you said these women will have a significant role in the politics of their country 20 years hence, you wouldn't believe me. And yet, now we see Michelle Bachelet has been elected president again in Chile, and Dilma Rousseff was elected president of Brazil, has set up a truth commission to investigate past wrongs by the authoritarian regime. And of course, Aung San Suu Kyi has won a seat in the new parliament. So I think when we look at that story, they are microcosms of this larger message I'm trying to talk about, that it is possible to break through, it is possible to change, it is possible to realize these ideals. But at the same time, they are precarious, they can be taken away, they need constant vigilance. And I think to respond to your question about bashing, you need patience. And I think sometimes in the foreign policy establishment, in the so-called international community, there's a certain impatience for change that takes place. If we look at the response to the Arab Spring, there was this almost willing the region to become democratic very quickly in a particular mold of liberal democracy. And the book actually says, well, there are varying definitions of democracy, and they have varying overlaps between the institutions of democracy and rights. They might only really focus on civil and political rights, or if you have a thicker definition, will also include economic and social rights. But all of the sort of embedding of those values making these institutions stick over the long run takes time. And that's something I think the world just needs to be a bit more patient about, that it does take time. If we look at some of the more sustainable and advanced democracies in the world, that didn't happen overnight. In some cases, it takes 100 or 200 years to consolidate the institutions of democracy. And even then, they might be unraveling. So it's that kind of precariousness and that message that I'm bringing across in the book.
So what approach did you take when writing the book?
Well, what I try to do is organize the book into what I call thematic couplets. I guess it's a bit of a nod to Shakespeare with his rhyming couplets. But I actually said, you know, the chapters are things like abundance and freedom. This is sort of the trade-off between economic well-being and democracy and the correlates of democracy, if you will. Also, democracy and human rights, how they relate to one another. They're not the same thing, and there are tensions between those two concepts. Another chapter is called Waves and Setbacks and looks at sort of the advance of democracy, but also the regression. We went through long periods of authoritarian rule in the 1970s and then transitions back to democracy in the 1980s. And a lot of the so-called transitional countries of post-Soviet period seem to have consolidated personalized rule and centralized authority in ways that undermine a commitment to democracy. So again, that precariousness comes out. Another chapter is on evidence and explanations, agents and advocates, truth and justice, threats and pitfalls, benefits and outcomes, and finally hopes and challenges. And I think it's that really messaging the themes, the sort of couplets running through the book gives the reader a sense of all the different facets of the current situation we find ourselves in.
So my impression is that while it's a book very much rooted in serious academic theory, it's also very much a book about the real world and not just about the past, but also about the present. Is that a fair sort of summary?
That's absolutely right. And the book opens with a series of pen portraits, really, about some countries that I had been to. And ironically, all three countries involved flying into quite arid mountainous regions. So I talk about flying into Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia and being struck by the sort of, this arid sense. This was an empty country. I mean, it's three times the size of France with roughly 3.5 to 4 million people. And when you fly into Ulaanbaatar, it's sort of stone and sand, and there are these giant power stations with power station number 1, 2, and 3 written on them. And you think, this is like something out of the movies, you know. And then flying into Mexico City, it's sort of a bowl at the top of a mountain, and you get that sense of just the vastness of Mexico and what this country holds. And the third city is Santiago de Chile, where you fly in over the Andes, sort of over Argentina, down across the Andes into this arid bowl of a city. And I talk about the sort of strides that all three of these countries have made to embrace democracy and some of the challenges that come with them. And for me, it's always grounded in those empirical experiences, those real experiences we've had, and some of the challenges. And I think when I do comparative analysis, I always like to reflect back on the places I've been and how that might inform some of the more structured comparisons that I do.
Now, I was very interested in your assertion that the threat of terrorism that we hear about almost daily in the news threatens to undermine the many human rights commitments that were the hallmarks of the 20th century. Is this a key conclusion of your work, of your body of work, of the book?
It's a deep worry of mine. I think that the response among quote-unquote liberal democracies or advanced democracies to the threat of terror has been worrisome. In the United Kingdom, anti-terror legislation was consolidated and made permanent before the 9/11 attacks. And then after the 9/11 attacks, there was a further grasp at centralization of executive authority. There was an attempt to detain foreign terror suspects without charge. That was then generalized to any terror suspect. They didn't have to be foreign, to house arrest and curfews, etc. And now we're having the same debates again on how to respond to ISIS. And there's similar concerns in the human rights community that the British state might go too far and work on, you know, taking away people's passports and, you know, halting their ability to travel and move, and might even, you know, some people are suggesting stripping people's citizenship away from them. So there's some really interesting challenges around that tension between security and rights. We also see international behavior from our advanced democracies as well, where they make alliances with non-democratic states in the fight for terror. They might look the other way if those partners in that alliance abuse human rights, but oh, it's okay because they're fighting terrorism. And it almost gives a green light, if you will, to some countries to continue to behave badly. And I think that whole kind of double standard at the moment that's out there is very, very troubling indeed. So yes, terrorism undermines rights, but it's not necessarily undermining rights in and of itself. It's the response to terrorism that is chipping away at that rights commitment. And that rights commitment has been something that has been born of struggle for centuries, actually. If we go right back to the Magna Carta and the history that comes from 1215 onward, these rights are very hard fought, hard won, and worth preserving. And I worry that in the short term, we might just throw those away.
That links nicely to the fact that you talk very much about the tangible benefits of democracy. What would you say they are?
Well, increasingly, a lot of the systematic comparative work around democracy is looking to see whether democracies deliver something other than just the values of democracy. Things like, you know, freedom and freedom of expression, assembly, etc. Those sorts of things are sort of part and parcel of democracy. But do they deliver economic benefit? And we're seeing now some research. Pippa Norris out of Harvard University has a very nice book on democratic governance and how it enhances peace, prosperity, distribution, a number of things like that. We did a project for the United Nations Development Program. We found some similar findings that democracies actually distribute wealth better than non-democracies. They tend not to have as much conflict or go to war with one another as much. There's a whole new sort of burgeoning literature around the pacifist benefits, if you will, of democratic rule. So there are the values in and of themselves that are worth preserving around freedoms, as well as some of these more material benefits and sort of the protection of peace and security.
Just finally then, Todd, who's the book for? Who will it be of interest to? How will it benefit or interest them? And what do you hope it might achieve?
Well, I think the organization of the book into the thematic couplets is something that someone could read a chapter one night, read a chapter the next day, dip into it, dip out of it, think about it. In that way, it makes it very accessible. There's not this sort of very long, dense argument that one needs to follow. It's bite-sized pieces. The intended audience is varied. Because I spent time working with intergovernmental agencies and non-governmental agencies at one level, I'm very interested in those audiences reading the book. In fact, I've been using it for some training workshops at the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance in Stockholm. I've used the content, and I will be using it again in the autumn with the European Commission's External Action Service in Brussels, and they work with the country delegation offices around the world, thinking about how democracy and human rights can be enhanced in all parts of the world. So there's that level of community I'm very interested in communicating with. There is also the community of students who have discovered my other work in whatever fashion, and then here's a free book that they can have. I can read it at their leisure. So it's students who want to come study with me, or it's students working on particular projects. And the third audience is just the general public. Anyone has a general interest in issues facing the world today, this is an accessible book, bite-sized chunks that people can access, look at, think about. And of course, they can always contact me to clarify what I've said. One of the things I really enjoy about the book is that Bloomsbury have made it available as a Creative Commons release, which means that there is a PDF file of the book that's available on my website. It's available on the publisher's website and other websites. So it's free to the world. And I think that philosophy of making that text free to the world to anybody who has a computer connection or can get access to a computer connection is consistent with a lot of the ideals that I write about in the book.
Todd Landman was talking to me, Chris Carrington, about his book Human Rights and Democracy, The Precarious Triumph of Ideals, which is published by Bloomsbury Publishing, but which is also downloadable for free as a PDF from Todd's website at www.todd-landman.com. This series is produced by Research Podcasts.